Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 50. Wow, can't believe we've hit the mark of 50 of season 5 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today in order to finish off this week is the godfather of the Movies by Minute community, and you know the guy who didn't start it all, but he helped. He constantly helps promote it, you know, producing group shows, producing his own shows. You know, it's always fun talking to him. Jim O'Kane, welcome back to the show, Jim.
I hope I can live up to all that, Rob. Thank you very much.
I think you're in a great week.
Yeah, well, I think I need to take a break one of these years just to go back and listen to see what I did wrong. But most of this has been from the help of the Movies by Minute community. I do some of the work, I do some of the background work, but a lot of it is just getting really quality speakers to be on the show. And
yeah, but you're like the engine behind everything that's pushing it. You know, you're the motor. You're the motor.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just I feel like I'm more like the tires. Everybody's pushing, you know, everybody does they're the gas. They're keeping me going.
Okay, but could be.
Yeah, no, it's fine. But anyway, well, enough of the analogy. Let's get back on an airplane.
All right, so episode 50 begins with Thornburg starting to move around the cabin and ends with Barnes giving a report. So we ended things yesterday with just a few seconds of, you know, Thornburg sitting. You refer to it in coach, but I have a feeling he's like in upscale business because of the way these seats are and the fact that, you know, Holly is the CEO of a major company. So my assumption is she's not flying coach. You know, if we want to compare this to Planes, Trains, and Automobiles from three seasons ago, this is a very different area of the plane than what Neil and Dell were sitting in. You know, it's a little more comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, do you think she took her shoes off and made fists in the carpet while she?
No, I don't think so. I don't think she did. But you see, that was good. You mixed together two different movies.
Yeah.
You know, because you know, Del takes off his socks and you know, John is making fists with his toes. But John probably already did. I wonder if John did that when he got to his in-laws. You know, he's flying with the kids. You know, you have Lucy and John Jr. You know, they get to the in-laws and they're like, "Daddy, what are you doing? I'm taking off my shoes in order to make fists with my toes, but my shoes are very close in case I need them."
Just in case. Yeah, and I just wonder if, you know, whenever things get troublesome with the in-laws, if he just kicks his shoes off under the table and starts making fists with his toes.
That's right. I remember back in probably 1989, there was I read an article, maybe it was in People magazine or something like that, where they were talking about that they were going to be making a sequel to Die Hard. And the idea then was that John has to like save one of his kids while they're at like a birthday party or something like that. And I just remember thinking that that's really funny that that's what they would do. And I was like, come on, we're never going to see those kids again. And, you know, we do end up seeing them at some point. You know, we'll get there.
Yeah, they come in when needed. I mean, it's kind of like seeing Reginald L. Johnson. It's like, oh, he needs to be in this part just to show. Yeah, remember that movie?
No, I think he was put in here because at this point he was already becoming more famous with Family Matters. So it was like, all right, let's just put a familiar face back in here.
Yeah, he was the day player. So in and out. I'm trying to figure out the atmosphere in the plane. I know this is back in the days when people were still smoking, but is it really that hazy in the aircraft? Because it just looks like there's clouds blowing around behind
Do you think in 1990 you were still able to smoke on a plane? I know I did a little bit of research on this two seasons ago.
I don't remember. It was all a horrible blur back then. I do remember that, you know, they'd have a non-smoking and a smoking section, but basically if you have a smoking section, the whole plane is a smoking section.
Or forget about that. Just even talking about the people sitting in the row or two at the end of the non-smoking section, you still are smelling the smoke.
Ah, it was, It was banned smoking on U.S. domestic flights of less than 2 hours, which became effective in 1988. The law was made permanent and extended to flights of less than 6 hours in 1990.
Okay, so that's right after this, because this apparently, you know, this was filmed in 89. So
yeah, so you know, apparently, possible. And this was a transcontinental flight. They're flying L.A. to D.C.
That's right, so which is a, over if I remember hours. Correctly, it's like a 4.5 hour flight. Or 4 hours and 50 minutes, something like that. Yeah, it's basically a 5 hour flight, which they've extended.
So I keep thinking of, you know, the diehard, to use the phrase, diehard smokers. I wonder if they were like, you know, scheduling transcontinental flights and flying backwards just so they could smoke while they're up in the air. But I didn't realize it was that. I knew it was sometime around then, but I didn't realize it was as late as 1990. You could still smoke on a plane.
Okay. Smoke them if you got
them. Well, there we are. Yeah. right. February 25th, 1990. That's when it was.
Right.
So,
okay.
Anyway.
And so Thornburg stands up. And I like the – I mean, there's a lot of leg room here because he moves past the woman who's sitting next to him without any problems. You don't see her having to, like, move to even like, swivel her feet around or something like that. So, you know, I guess Northeast Airline is a good airline to fly if you want more legroom.
Yeah. It's this is an L-1011, I believe. I'm not sure.
I don't know.
Actually, the man that's coming next week will be able to tell you. But I think that was a, you know, a wide body plane, but it was a narrow wide body. Just interesting. Gosh, those days of 33 inch seat pitches are long gone. But
yeah, I mean, but this is also a set. This isn't a real plane, so.
yeah, it's a plane for purposes of this movie.
Yes.
I remember Northeast back in the day, which.
Okay, so Northeast, the original Northeast was bought up by Delta in 1971.
Okay, and this isn't it. Did they still use the livery though?
I was
wondering if they retired the livery. Okay.
I believe that they were completely absorbed by Delta. Now, I mean, I talked about this, I think it was last week or maybe it was the week before, how the Northeast Airlines was originally going to be bought up by Northwest. Yep. And then something went awry. And in the end, it was Delta who purchased them.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, they always used to advertise the Northeast Yellowbirds, which were old. They were Convair 880s, and they're kind of like the knockoff brand of a 707. They were actually faster than a 707, but I remember the Northeast Yellowbirds. They were bright yellow. I mean, like,
oh wow,
school bus yellow, and they were constantly. Anytime you turn on a radio in the New England or New York area, all you'd hear would be Northeast commercials because I think they really wanted a lot of commuter. Mostly, it was between New York and Florida. I think there were a lot of New York and Florida, or Boston and Florida. You fly to Miami, so they were part of the. Obviously, they were big jet setters for the East.
Right. Northeast Airlines.
Yeah, even though they flew to the Southeast, but of course you've got Southwest Airlines, which is, you know, they fly to Baltimore. So it's an interesting. It when I saw the Northeast logo on the side of this plane, I was like, I remember that. It's a nice memory just to see that, even though, you know, it's been out of business for years and years.
Yeah, that's true. So, and then he keeps walking towards the right of the screen, and you know he again the woman doesn't even bat an eye as he's walking by. And then, you know, we see that the elderly woman who was sitting next to Holly is not in her seat. And then he walks over and gets really, really close to Holly, which you'd think he would be a little smarter than that. Like, is it that difficult to try and go out to, like, a different window to look out at what you're seeing? You know, obviously, again, it's for the plot, but, you know. And I love how her jacket or sweater or something is just, like, thrown over the back of the seat.
Yeah, I'm sure the people behind her love that.
Yes. Well, the two people behind, basically every person that we've seen in this scene, you know, both yesterday and today, they're all listening to their headphones. You know, because the two people behind Holly are also listening to their headphones. Holly and Thornburg are the only two who aren't, because then maybe they can have, you know, a conversation. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and you can you can hear her typing on a, I guess, a personal computer at the time. And, you know, he, again, he gets very, very close and looks out, and we see two planes flying by, which, I mean, again, Hal will be able to explain this a little better to me next week, but, you know, they do look pretty close. You think you think that even in situations like this, they would have a way of, you know, keeping the planes at a further distance.
Yeah, and I would think they'd all be in a pattern. There's a holding pattern, so they would orbit around a VOR, some kind of a there's a marker, you know, out far, maybe like 15 miles, 20 miles from the airport, and they'd just be circling that, so they would never see each other, except if you were looking down, and you know they'd all be going in the same direction. There wouldn't be any of these collision styled directions. I'm wondering when the first line that we get in this entire in this minute is when Holly says to him, "I think you're closer than
50 yards."
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know he was given a she was given an order of protection. She was given a stay away. Does that I'm assuming that she got that in a California court. Does California law apply in the air over Virginia? I was wondering.
Yeah. We did discuss that a little bit when Alan Sanders was on in week four, when they talked about that, because there was the argument about whether it was 50 yards or 50 feet. But we didn't come up with a solution as to whether, you know, whether that's something that's considered a national, you know, law. I you think if someone has a restraining order against them, you think it's not only in that jurisdiction.
Yeah. I just don't know. Yeah, I mean, I guess he could face penalties when he got back to California, as long as he never came back to California.
No, well, she's the one who has to face penalties because, you know.
Oh yeah, she's the one.
It's a protection of order. She can't come close to him.
Ah, so
yeah,
that could be his decision to get close. I mean, she's not attempting it anyway.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. And then his response is, so is that airplane practically. Yeah. Okay, I'd be very scared if that plane was really only 50 yards away. You know,
that's... it's. I think it's a little bit. I mean, if that's like a 747, it seems to be a little further away. It's difficult to judge distance unless you're like trained for it. A lot of problems people have.
But 150 feet is nothing.
Yeah, no, you'd be
when you're talking about aviation.
That's like the length of the tail on a 747. So you're. Right. Yeah, but it's always interesting. People have a problem with scale. They see smaller planes, and people will think that they're going faster than you see a large plane like an Airbus 340 or something like that, and they say, "Wow, it's really moving slow." But actually, your brain doesn't process the scale of planes. They all in your head, you kind of see them all at the same size. So the small planes are traveling across a piece of the sky. It seems faster than watching a large plane moving at a much faster speed, because your brain is processing the time it takes the nose to the tail to pass the same piece of sky.
Right, that's true. And then we get another shot after he says, "So is that airplane practically?" We see another shot of the outside, which again it's very fake, but. You know, we see one what looks like sort of a plane, and then a whole bunch of lights, you know, to try to make us believe that there are other planes out there. And then Holly, you know, reluctantly engages in conversation with him, even though she doesn't really want to. And he goes, "Yeah, there's quite a few of them out there. Looks like a regular traffic jam." And then his response is "There's nothing regular about it." Okay, now traffic jams, you know. So do you know any other terms for a traffic jam?
A snarl,
Ooh, very good. I never had heard that before. Yes. And that is one of the ones.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Snarl. Let's see. Oh gosh, this is like when I'm trying to solve Wordle questions. What's another synonym? let me let you fill in the blanks on those. A traffic jam, a snarl, a gridlock. There might be one.
Okay, yes, gridlock is another one. And also a tailback. That's the other one.
A tailback. I've never heard that. That's intriguing.
Neither have I. That's and what do you think there right now? I've found a list of the six largest causes of traffic jams. What do you think? What do you think would be on the list?
I'm going to go with a collision, some kind of an accident. I would say simply the number of cars on the road. I know that when the density of cars increases on a road, speed decreases. It's just a reaction that people have when they see a lot of cars, they slow down. Even if you're going, if you're going 60 miles an hour, you see a lot of cars on the road, you slow to 40. People just slow down simply to the density. And I would say another one would be merging. I would think any kind of place where lanes merge, that would cause a slowdown or a jam. But I'm sure you have many others.
Okay, so there are six main reasons for traffic jams. We'll go from bottom to top. So first of all, you have here poor signal timing. It usually causes about 5% of traffic jams. You know, the fact that you have a green light here and a red light there, and, that's obviously going to cause problems. Then you have something that says special events. That's also 5%, whether, the president's in town.
Football game lets out, everybody.
Right. Yeah. The football game, president's in town, those type of things. Bad weather is around 15%. Because it goes back to what you were saying before. When the roads are wet or icy, so people will be driving slower. And when you drive slower, there will be more congestion. Okay. Then you.
I have a quick story about that.
Sure.
I used to live in the DC area, which is very heavily populated by diplomatic corps. Lots of different countries send embassies and things like that. There's a lot of embassy staff. And not too far from Dulles Airport, there's a Route 7 in Virginia. I can remember being in a snowstorm, and one of the things about that, there are frequent snowstorms in Virginia during the winter, but many people that have come, embassy staff, diplomatic personnel, many of them come from countries where snow is not a common event, and it's an unusual. It seems unusual, but it's a typical event when people that have not dealt with winter weather. Suddenly find themselves struggling to drive in the snow, they will abandon their cars in the middle of the highway. Like, they won't pull off to the side, and they'll just leave the car there and walk to a building or a gas station or something like that, and just leaving the car there until the snow goes. And I can just remember the entirety of Route 7 being closed down because people had just left their cars on the highway without moving to the side, and there was no way to move on the highway simply because there was a stationary, unoccupied traffic jam.
Wow.
that extended through Route 7. But,
right.
And that happened many times.
I'm actually very familiar with that exact phenomenon. I mean, I live in Israel, so usually we have 1 or 2 days of snow every year, approximately.
Okay.
And I remember, I think maybe this was in 1999 or 2000, I was driving from my home in Jerusalem to work, and it was snowing, and there were just cars that were abandoned in the middle of the road in the snow. People just got out, and that was it. They said, okay, my car's not going, and apparently no one else is either. And it took me probably like an hour to get out of the city, which is usually a 7-minute drive, something like that. And then, and then after that, there was no snow because, it was a, higher elevation, lower elevation. So there wasn't snow there. So I'm very familiar with that type of story.
It's just a fascinating, trait of humanity.
Yes.
When if you're faced with something you can't do, it's like, well, game over. I'm done here. Goodbye.
That's right.
But yeah, it's a, wow, we're recording in the middle of the summer, so it's difficult to think of snow. But we're talking about a movie that's taking place.
Even if it's all fake snow, so that's fine.
Yeah.
Then the next on the list is work zones, so that causes traffic jams, obviously. you know, both because they usually change the speed limit, and they also, you know, sometimes, you know, they'll close a lane or something like that. Then the next one on the list is traffic incidents, based on what you said before, you know, accidents and stuff like that, which my assumption is that, you know, actually, I'll, and then the top thing on this list that says 40% of all traffic jams are caused by bottlenecks. Okay. So then my question is yeah, okay, yeah. where is rubbernecking here? You know, does rubbernecking fit into the bottlenecks or the traffic incidents? Because it's both. It's the idea that, okay, there's you know, for those who don't know, a rubbernecking is when there's an accident or some sort of incident on the other side of the road and everyone slows down to take a look, you know, the vampires. Yes. You know, just.
Yeah. It's a very descriptive phrase. You know, let me just see what's going on. And
that's right.
Here in Texas, they've put up traffic signs where they tell you, there's cameras and everything all over the place, so they can tell you what's coming up in the next mile or two. If there's a collision at, you know, the corner of Main Street and whatever, they'll tell you what's coming up. And those signs were put up in the hopes that letting people know what kind of accident was up ahead would get the rubbernecking to a minimum. But all it did was people would speed up to go see what the accident looked
and,
like.
So and causing more accidents.
And and there's all kinds of velocity changes. I think changes in velocity is one of the most frequent causes of collisions on the road.
Yeah.
So it just made things worse instead of better. So now I've noticed that there's a lot fewer mentions of traffic accidents other than congestion ahead. That's all
they
put up on the sign.
Yeah, you know, it's most frustrating when you're stuck in a traffic jam. And then, you know, everything just opens up and you don't know why you were in that jam. You know, like, there's no accident here. There's no, you know.
I need answers, yeah.
That's right. What city do you think has the worst traffic jams in the world?
What city has the worst traffic jams? Well, I've driven in Paris. That's pretty bad. Houston is not pleasant. I would think something with... I don't know. I'm going to guess Paris, but
no, São Paulo.
São Paulo. Okay.
Yeah.
I've never driven there, but I don't intend to. So I'm
yeah. No.
It sounds like something to avoid.
Yeah. Not familiar about that either. But that's a place that I wouldn't necessarily want to be if there's that many traffic jams. Yeah.
Wow. Paris. I've driven in Paris twice. And it's an unforgettable experience where everybody seems to just throw themselves into there's multiple lanes, but there's no lane markers. It's just kind of a very wide avenue. Mm. And if you go up by Arc de Triomphe, you're getting in the circle and you're going to get out and you just have to know where you're going because nobody's going to let you in and nobody's going to let you out. I think I did two circuits of the Arc de Triomphe just to get out of there because I could not figure out how to get over to where I needed to be.
Wow.
I wonder how much traffic problems are caused by sat nav systems because as roads change, I've been yelled at several times by my navigation system in my car because it thinks there should be a road there, but the roads have been remodeled and it's maybe 50 feet to the left and it keeps saying return to the route.
Well, I am on the route. That's why I turn off the sound.
Yeah.
Yes, I've had that also. It's told me that I've gone into areas where I should not be driving and stuff like that. It's like you're not on the road and I am on the road. It just, you know, just pushed off a little bit. So you started mentioning that the next comment is something that really was maybe intrigued by.
Let me see if we're up to he talks about.
He says there's nothing regular about it. And then he goes, see, you're intrigued. That's my gift, Mrs. McLean.
Yes.
I notice things other people wouldn't see. That's how I make people curious.
Yes, and her comeback is, don't you mean nauseous? And I have a fourth wall question here. Is he breaking the fourth wall? Because I think if you look at second 54, he's not looking at her. He's looking right at the camera. Like, you know, you're expecting to hear some kind of a blah blah kind of a musical note as he's looking, but I could swear that he's addressing the audience at that point with, "Can you believe this girl?"
Yeah, but I mean, the conversation continues a little bit after that also, where he says, "Look, yeah. The people have the right to know everything about everybody. You got in the way of that." Okay, so my first question about that is, this is basically a future, not a callback, but a future call towards reality TV, because that is why reality TV is so popular, because everyone is so curious about other people's lives and how they live things and stuff like that. You know, just even thinking about all the Real Housewives, I'm not even talking about reality competitions. Reality competitions is the same thing also. You know, the way that people are, you know, nobody would have expected, you know, 25 years ago or even 33 years ago when this movie came out, that reality TV would become so popular. You know, especially when there's a writer's strike.
he could wind up being the host of, you know, Love Island or something. You
exactly.
Know, obviously, that would be the route of his career.
Yeah. Yeah. And then her response is great. She goes, "Listen, Buster, you endangered my children and you didn't do it for anything as noble as the people. The only time you ever see the people is when you look down to see what it is that you're stepping on." And at that point, that's the look on his face that he's looking at us. Now, first of all, how did he endanger her children? He basically endangered her.
Yeah. Well, they might have taken away the nanny or the housekeeper that was there.
She's referring to Paulina here? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
It's not like Hans Gruber. It's not like Hans Gruber would have said, "Oh, they've got kids. Let's go get them too." You know, that doesn't.
Yeah. in terms of her kids would be orphans, or
that endangers them from that perspective. I don't know.
I don't know why he would. Yeah, it's. Maybe the screenwriters didn't watch the first movie. I'm not sure.
Maybe. Even though it's the same screenwriter. But yeah, okay. He doesn't remember.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just all a different world. When they were writing out the script, they were looking at the novelization, which was, you know, the Frank Sinatra thing.
Right.
But yeah, it's just very peculiar. But yeah, I just that one moment when he's looking.
Yes.
It caught me when he's looking right at the camera.
Yes. He's basically looking at the camera. You're right. I think it is an attempt to break the fourth wall. I do believe it is. It's a subtle attempt to do so. Now, she calls him Buster.
Yeah.
You know, do you know anybody named Buster?
Buster Keaton, I can think of. My uncle Bill, when he was a kid, he was nicknamed Buster. People called him Buster, but only. There were only certain people from school, from what I understand.
Mm, okay. Do you know what the name Buster means?
I would think somebody that gives you a hard time. I'm not sure.
No, it actually means someone who's a tough guy.
Oh, okay.
You know, so like I had only heard of a few Busters beforehand, never in person. Just things from movies or TV or whatever. Obviously, you mentioned Buster Keaton.
Buster Crabbe. Buster Crabbe, I would say. Another one, Buster Keaton.
Right. Gosh. So Buster Keaton. So he actually was nicknamed Buster when he was 18 months old, because he fell down a long flight of stairs and didn't get injured. And a friend of the family named George Pardee said, "Gee whiz, he's a regular Buster." So then they started just calling him Buster at that point. You know, the only other ones I can think of was Buster Brown. You know, for the cartoon character and the shoe store.
Loved his shoes, yeah.
That's right. Then Buster is the name of Andy's dog in Toy Story.
And Buster Crabbe, the original Flash Gordon.
Yes, correct. And I found a list of 10 different jazz musicians whose names were Buster, which I found really strange that, you know, Buster must be... you know, a common jazz name.
Wow. Yeah, I was not familiar with that.
No, I mean, I don't know any of them. You know, Buster Bailey, Buster Bennett, Buster Benton, Buster Brown, another one, Buster Cooper, Buster Harding, Buster Michael, Buster Smith, Buster Williams, and Buster Wilson.
Wow.
That was just an interesting interlude.
if you're at a jazz club and somebody says, you know, I'm looking for Buster, and somebody shows up and says, no, you've got the wrong Buster. It's wow. Yeah, that's one of those things that have just kind of dissolved. I don't know anybody of recent memory that named Buster, but
yeah.
If anybody listening in is nicknamed Buster, please give us your story.
Yeah. Yeah. Because one of the things I was trying to find out was, is Buster like a nickname for something? You know, like, is it a nickname for a particular name? You know, like Jim is usually short for James, or, you know, Rob or Bob, or, you know, or Bobby or whatever. Those are, you know, derivatives of the name Robert, you know, things like that. So I was trying to think of, like, what's Buster? Because your name is Buster Furious or something like that? I don't know.
Yeah, because like my Uncle Bill was Buster, but it's like Buster Crab was Larry Crab, but he also went by his first name was Clarence and his second name was Larry. So then he went by Larry Buster Crab. I guess when you find a name that sticks with you, it's just odd. But it doesn't derive from anything. I don't know where Buster would come from as another name.
Right. I mean, if you're thinking about, Buster Keaton, I mean, his original name also, it doesn't make any, his name was Joseph Frank.
Yeah.
You know, that.
Wow.
I also saw somewhere that it says that Lou Gehrig's nickname was Buster, but it's on one place it said that that's his nickname, but then, you know, I couldn't find any derivatives. His name was Henry Lewis. Even though his original name, did you know that he's German? It was Heinrich Ludwig. That was his, he was born.
Wow.
You know, Lou Gehrig was Heinrich Ludwig Gehrig. Huh. Yeah. So the things you learn on this podcast.
Yeah. It's just a cornucopia of knowledge here.
Yeah.
It may come in handy someday. We'll find out. You know, just hang on to all these little snippets and someday they could pay off.
Maybe. And then the shot changes after this the pseudo break of the fourth wall, and we get we see some EMTs working on one of the bodies. You know, I wouldn't necessarily say that they're taking care of this body very well, because you hear like they apparently are trying to revive the guy, but when they pick up the paddles, it sounds like they're pulling Velcro. You know, sound doesn't really work very well there, and I love the fact that the two places where the paddles are, it looks like it's very bloody in those two spots.
Yeah, or either that, or it looks like he was covered in salsa or something. It just,
yes.
That blood is not I understand that it's a movie, but I think they would come up with a better color than that fluorescent orange. It looks kind of like. I don't know if your folks ever used Mercurochrome on you when you were a kid, but we used to have that. There was this antiseptic salve that was put on any kind of scrapes or on your knees or shins or things like that, and it was called Mercurochrome. It was bright, almost that fluorescent orange, and it stung like.
You mean like is it like an iodine type of thing?
It was methylate, which I think, or mercurochrome and methylate. I probably had mercury in it. It was probably super dangerous, but they used it anyway. I'm going to Google. But it was also known as the typical thing that things like camp counselors and teachers called it. Monkey blood was the nickname for it. It's a disodium salt, organomercuric disodium salt compound used as a topical anesthetic for cuts and scrapes, and as a biological dye. It's no longer sold in Switzerland, Brazil, France, Iran, Germany, Denmark, or United States due to its mercury content. Mm-hmm. Best known as a topical antiseptic to treat minor wounds, burns, and scratches. It's often used as the antiseptic of the umbilical cord and the antiseptic of wounds with inhibited scar formation. So it prevents scarring.
Mm, interesting.
It has a distinctive carmine red that will persist on skin through repeated washings. That's true. You had bright fluorescent skin for quite some time. Due to its persistence and to its lethality to bacteria as an antiseptic, mercurochrome is useful on infections of the fingernails or toenails. It was generally recognized as safe in 1998, but then it was moved, or 1998 went from generally recognized as safe to untested due to a lack of recent studies and updated supporting information. So now they just recommend use iodine instead.
Yeah, okay, makes
but
sense.
All it hurt like nobody's business. I can't. It was like somebody just poured Sterno on your shins. it's one of those things. I'm very glad it's gone. They probably use that the triple antibiotic stuff now instead. But boy, did that hurt. Anyway, that's what this reminded me of. If you had that much mercurochrome on your cuts, as you're seeing in this picture, you'd be screaming. This guy would not be unconscious.
Well, he's dead, so he's not gonna.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what they do. Maybe they put that on him to see if he's dead.
Yeah.
Because if he's not dead, he'll scream.
Yeah, it's a very good test. That much mercurochrome, and he would probably get up and run across. He could probably stand the scaffolding up after that happened.
Just
grab things and start stacking them.
That's probably true. Right. So again, these paramedics are trying to deal with the SWAT guy to no avail. And then, we see this for a few seconds, and then we hear Barnes on a cell phone, and he goes, "Me? Yeah." And then he gets cut off. So people are going to have to come back on Monday to find out what else he says.
It's got to be a mystery all weekend. Yes. Like they can chew over it. One thing I thought is that if I were writing the script, and this is why I don't write scripts, it's just everybody that shows up, every paramedic, every kind of rescue personnel, they're all turncoats. Everybody, like, they get there and they start working on the guy, and then they all reach into their medical kits and they pull out 9mm pistols and start trying to shoot McClane, and then he has to kill them too. And just continue. It continuously, everybody that he meets is the bad guy. Again, that's why I don't get to write scripts.
You can. I mean, is something that has happened in other movies.
And just let him do a Thornburg thing with of looking at the camera, going, "This never ends."
That's right.
Wow.
All right. So, Jim, you have anything else you want to say about this minute or the movie in general before we get into the script?
I keep thinking of this as the antithesis of Empire Strikes Back. It's more the rule than the exception. Empire Strikes Back was a sequel that was, to me, in my opinion, and I know other people's opinions differ. Empire Strikes Back was a movie that was better than its original one. It was a better sequel than the original. The Die Hard 2 is it was kind of a weak copy of an original masterpiece. But it's difficult. I mean, you have to admit, it's difficult to follow up such a classic film as the original Die Hard. So the whole production crew was under a lot of pressure to come out with a good film. However, it does deliver in terms of just sheer entertainment value. Talking about popcorn movies, this is definitely a top popcorn movie. You don't have to think too hard. This is not built as a reflection on society or any kind of deep thoughts. This is an action movie, and the only thing you're interested in is this massive video game that John McClane has to get from one side of the video game to the other and reach the top boss on the top level. So it's for entertainment potential, it is mission accomplished for this film.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. All right, so the script is pretty much the same. The dialogue is almost exact. Just one of the descriptions I thought I really liked. It says, Thornburg releases his seatbelt and goes over to the glass, pressing his nose against it like a kid in a candy store. I think it would have been more of a problem had he actually gone all the way to the window.
with his hands on either side and just squishing up against. Yeah,
that's right. I think Holly would have been a little more offended. And then it says, Holly looks at him. She can't help not looking at him. He's practically in her lap. And then she says, you're closer than 50 yards. And he goes, so is that plane? And then she looks out the window and says, it's about the traffic jam. And then, he continues about it instead of make people curious. She says, don't you mean nauseous? And then he goes, the people have the right to know, Mrs. McClane. You got in the way of that. She says, you engendered my children, my husband, and me. Which makes it a little better, the fact that she's saying all of them, not just his children. And then she says, and she continues and says, and you didn't do it for anything as noble as the people. The only time you see the people is when you're climbing over their backs. And then, you know, it shows that back with McLean, and this is McLean is doing a damn decent field dressing on Barnes. You know, and then Barnes has his little line about me. Yeah. And that's it. So, I mean, not much change here. I like the way it's done in the movie. I don't think it's needed to be changed at all. The little nuances and stuff like that. So here's something that I've been anticipating all season to do to surprise you, Jim. Okay. Uh-oh. So yeah. So the segment that I do on Friday is called Where Are They Up To This Weekend? Okay. And I decided that what I'm going to be doing is, you know, trying to test my guests' memories of some of their favorite movies or movies that they've done, movies by minute or whatever it is. And, you know, so here we've just finished minute 50 of this movie. So I'm now want to see with, you know, your memory, Jim, if you can remember where some of the movies that you've done were up to. What's going on at minute 50?
At minute in them. So, 50. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, this is vicious.
Wait. We'll go in order. So let's start with Airport. What do you think is going on in Airport at minute 50? Again, I give a little bit of leeway. I understand there are different versions out there and stuff like that.
Well, okay. The first hour of the movie is the lead up to the bombing. So I'm thinking Ada Quonset has just boarded the plane. I think that's about that. She's either getting sick she's pretending to get sick and heading for the ladies' room, and leaving Peter Coakley behind. So that's what I'm guessing. Airport at minute 50 is about that scene.
No, okay. Well, first of all, that scene is around minute 57, with what you're talking about, where she goes into the bathroom.
Okay, so
this is actually a conversation between Dean Martin's character and the woman that he's gotten pregnant. You probably remember the names much better than I do.
Gwen Burden.
Right. Yeah. So you know, the two of them are having their conversation in an empty plane. You know, that's what's going on here in Airport.
They're discussing whether or not to go to Sweden or not.
Correct. Okay. All right. So that's Airplane. So now let's go to the Andromeda Strain. What do you think is happening at minute 50 of the Andromeda Strain?
Wow, it's pretty late into the movie. I would think, oh boy, this is tough. This is a very good test because I'm going to stink at this. 50 minutes into the movie, I would say, I'm going to go with Jeremy, Dr. Stone. Is waving he's waving a paper at the video screen, yelling, I have the message in my hand. How come I was never notified? I think it's because the MCM transmission didn't go through. That's my guess.
No, they're still going through the various levels of.
Oh wow!
Of,
okay.
Yes, they're right now about to enter the yellow level they get the yellow jumpsuits and then, minute 51 is where they have to strip down and then put the strange hats on their heads in order to make sure that, that nothing happens to the hair on the top of their heads or their eyebrows.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Wow. Oh, that, again, Robert Wise was very ponderous. It was a very ponderous movie. You're like things that would have happened in the first half hour kind of get stretched out to the hour.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's go with the Rocketeer. What do you think is going on in the Rocketeer at minute 50?
Let's see. I'm gonna go with. I'm 2 hours, so halfway through. I'm guessing that the Rocketeer and PV are trying to figure. The Rocketeer and PV are trying to figure out why their house was shot up. That's what I'm guessing.
Okay, you were very close. It's right before that. It's when they find the address.
Oh, yeah. Palm Terrace. Yeah.
1635 Palm Terrace. Yeah. Correct. So that they find that, and then the FBI shows up at that house also, where the two of them are there. And, you know, then they fight the baddie.
Yeah. That's right. Okay. Lothar.
That's wow. Right. Okay. Now we'll go to the final movie that you've done so far is Apollo 13. What is happening at minute 50?
Oh, that has to be, let's see. It's either just before or just after stirring the cryo tanks, because that all happens around. It's just before the 1 hour mark is when the ship is dying. So it has to be like either immediately before or immediately after. It's right in the Houston, we have a problem. The big jump.
That's right. Very good.
Am I? Oh, yes.
Yes.
Hooray.
It is exactly.
I got one.
That's right. And hey, you know, no, you were close. You were close with the Rocketeer. I have to give you a little bit of leeway on this type of thing. You know, the idea is.
Yeah, and it's been years too. It's been like, I think we did Rocketeer was in 2016 or 17, and then Apollo 13 was 2018. Then we had a 6 month break. And then came back and finished it. We finished with, I can tell you what happened at minute 75, because that's when we came back after a 6 month hiatus. But, okay. Wow. Well, that is quite a workout. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we're not done yet. Okay. We're not done yet, Jim. I got two more little surprises for you. So one of them is October Sky. Because I know that's something that you plan on doing in the near future. So I'm curious if you have any idea what's going on there.
Homer. Wow. This is another one that's slow. So it would be, I think it's just before he gets, it's before he gets, sent back down into the mines when he quits school. When he quits school and gets sent back down to the mines, I think it would be
No, it's right after they get arrested.
Okay.
And this is actually one of my favorite scenes in this movie. I just rewatched it yesterday, and it's when, you know, Chris Cooper, who plays Homer's dad, you know, tells Homer to get in the car, and then he goes to help Homer's friend, you know, who's being beaten up by his stepfather. You know,
great scene.
That's a very pivotal scene in the movie, because, you know, for anyone who's seen the movie, and hopefully, you know, if you haven't, you should go, and hopefully I'm not spoiling too much, but it's one of the first points where we can see how much Homer really, or how much Homer's dad is a stand-up guy, and it really is heroic in what he does in his life.
Yeah, yeah, and the movie is just as much about Homer's dad as it is about Homer.
I think it's more about his father now that I look at it.
Yeah, I think it's just understanding that thing. And I mean it's not a secret that we're going to be doing Hal and I are going to be doing October Sky, and that's one of the things that we're going to talk about with director Joe Johnson in future episodes. So stay tuned for October Sky Minute. But it is Joe Johnson's favorite movie. Just to
And I remember you told me that months ago, and I couldn't understand why. And now that I rewatched it yesterday, I completely understand why.
I mean, it's not about history, and it's not about rockets. It's about people. It's about family and relationships, and getting used to the idea that your kids don't grow up the way you expect them to. But they, you know, they'll surprise
you. But you still are able to instill in them certain, you know, aspects of their life, of their personality, and, you know, how they deal with different types of situations. Even if they don't follow your dreams, they follow their own dreams.
Yeah, yeah. It's he said Joe Johnson said to us, no grown man can walk away from the final scenes without crying. And I agree. It's just, it's such an emotionally tearing thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now I got to go watch it again.
Yeah. Okay. You can do that. I already did. Okay. So now the final one is sort of just a little teaser for you. Okay. Cause I know there's no way that you're going to be able to do this, and I couldn't do it either. You know? So I know that you also have plans in the future to do From the Earth to the Moon. which is 12 yes. episodes. So we're not going to go through all 12 episodes. Don't worry. Both you, Jim, don't worry, and both the listeners, don't worry, because you know we're not going to sit and go through 12 different episodes. So my first question is of the 12 episodes, how many of them do not reach the 50-minute mark? So you know, some of them wouldn't have what to talk about if I were to do that.
Yeah, most of them, I would think almost 90% of them, because they're all like 8-minute segments or 12-minute segments. I think the longest one is.
Again, I'm not talking about segments. I'm not talking about the segments. Oh, I'm talking about the episodes.
Oh, the episode themselves.
Yeah.
I think they all reach close to either like 45 or to 50 minutes. I think more than half of them do. Almost 80%, I would guess.
80% make it past the 50 yeah. mark, right? Okay, so yeah. There are three that do not. Episodes 7, 8, and 9 are the only three that don't reach that. One of them misses 50 by 12 seconds. You know, it's that close.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Wow. Okay.
And this one I'm not gonna make you guess on, but I will tell you. So in the very first episode, which is probably my favorite of the entire. I mean, I love the whole miniseries, but I think the first episode has always been my favorite. So in that one, what happens? It's at the 50-minute mark. It's where Jim Lovell and Buzz Aldrin are together on the Gemini mission, where they finally are able to get the final part done. And they knew from that, okay, now they can move on to the next stage of going to the Apollo stage and getting there, you know, getting to the moon.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah, and that was before Buzz started making meth out in the middle of the New Mexico desert.
That's right. And this is also 10 minutes before the episode even ends. Because I mean, the final scene to me always gets me in that first episode. You know, one of the men sitting in the, who just came in this room will be the first man to walk on the moon. You know, that type of thing. So, Jim, this has been a really, really fun week with you. I hope the last 10 minutes hasn't been too much of a torture for you.
No, it's been fascinating about how much I don't know about the stuff I've been working on for years, but it's an intriguing way of looking at it, especially when we're doing it minute by minute by minute.
Yeah. So, I mean, the trick that I try to use, and I can't say it'll always work, is I try to think back of who was my guest during that week in order to try and remember what is happening. It sometimes works, sometimes doesn't work. It's possible that if someone does this to me, I will not remember, you know, what is going on in The Great Escape at minute 50, or what's going on. Actually, The Great Escape, I do know what happened at minute 50. because I can think of who my guest was. That's what it comes down to. So, All right. So,
wow. Well, impressive.
Yeah. So, Jim, you want to tell people how they can get, where they can find Jim O'Kane?
Yeah, it's really, you can find me online at easy to remember, jimokane.com, JIMOKANE. Don't use the apostrophe on there, .com. And you can find all my wayward hobbies out there. I have a bunch of different websites. One of the oldest ones on the web, actually, it's older than Google. It's tvdads.com, where we go over the history of single dads on television, everything from My Little Margie to The Mandalorian. So you can read about the rules of single dads out there too. So it's always a lot of fun. If you see any single dads that I've missed, I'd be happy to hear from you. There's contact information on the site, tvdads.com.
All right. Very cool. And it is a great site. It unfortunately, you know, like most things on the internet, when you start going there and you say, I'm just going to do it for 5 minutes, you get stuck there for hours. So again, it's not a knock at you, Jim, but it's because it's so fascinating.
No.
You know, it takes away time from other things. I always warn
people that as you do that, you'll suddenly wake up at, you know, 1 a.m. and go, wait a minute, Sanford and Son, wasn't that a single dad show? So that I apologize in advance for people who are going to go through that.
All right. So finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Facebook. So, Jim, once again, thank you very much for joining me. I hope that you'll agree to come back next season. You know, we'll have to find time for that. But I hope so. It's always been a pleasure having you on. And, you know, I always look forward to having these conversations, because you and I have a lot in common when it comes to the way that our minds work when looking at movies.
I Yes, yes, we spend way too much time thinking about it, but that's
important. No, but I don't see that as a negative. I think that's the problem. Everyone else in the world looks at that as a negative, but we don't. You know, which is why it's fun.
Very much. All right. Yes. Well, thank you.
All right. So I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here.